Are you ready? Quick review. Last time we talked about Dream 29 and 30. Dream 29 was the Esslingen dream, where the anima was... Turn on the radio, maybe?
I was just going to...
The anima that would represent the unity of spirit matter was located in Esslingen, which we took as like Terre Haute or Frankfurt or something like that, just a place that you wouldn't find exciting. And, of course, Pelli took it one way, that it was about Jung. Jung said, no, it's about you, and about your feeling about what you get involved in to do this work. And then I think the author rightly felt that that was confirmed in the next dream, where Pelli is at the Eteha, and this Chinese woman, whom he said is a version of the dark woman, is asking him to lecture. So that picks up on a previous theme, that it's really his job to start lecturing on this material. A couple of the other things we talked about, just in general, this you'll hear this, you know, in my field, and it's a good example, I think, for you to envision. This is a split anima. This guy's got a split anima. In other words, part of his emotions, part of his valuing, is in the high intellectual. And yet, despite himself, part of his emotions are in the very concrete and earthy. We saw that surfacing probably in his visits to prostitutes. And on the other hand, it's also the part of him that's attracted to understanding the psychological function of matter, because that is not brilliant, that is not wonderful, that is not the light world of thought that the other one is. And he can't get these two together. What he's being asked to do personally is to get these two together in himself, and also then for the field. So you could say that science has a split anima as well. His version is his own contradictory feeling side, but science itself only has a way of registering one dimension of the feminine, which is the light-inspiring side. The split anima, usually, you know, when was it, a couple years ago, in the Academy Awards, it's been more than a couple years ago, but all the films with women in them that won, the woman was either a saint or a whore. Mm-hmm. So that's the split as it shows up collectively. Pelli had his version, and it apparently lies behind the science issue as well. We talked about his trip to India, how that really wasn't part of his task. And we ended with page 110, where he's saying how he doesn't believe in the direct concretization of rhythmic images, which is a denial of everything that we've been talking about. So we're going to see that split in such statements. One correction, Carl was right, there was a word missing on page 107. The last unindented paragraph, as already presented in Chapter 3, the circulation of the light means self-incarnation. The word is the word that's missing is means. The circulation of the light means self-incarnation. And that takes us to the middle of 110.
When you said this, I believe in the direct concretization of images, what does that mean exactly?
I took it to mean he really doesn't think that the material world can act symbolically.
Okay.
Yeah, he's just denying synchronicity. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to see a week later, he says the opposite. that's why it's so hard to get our head around this stuff, and why it would be so hard to have a relationship with somebody like this. One moment it's one thing, and one moment it's next. And I bet you anything, I was thinking about this last night, if you said, now, Mr. Pally, you just said here that you don't believe in the direct concretization of images, that he would say, oh, no, here's what I really mean. He would change just like that. But had he got into a synchronicity, 5 minutes later, he would have denied it. That's the way these things work. They flip back and forth so quickly. And there is no continuity. And just to give you, you know, Jung 101 in this context, this is what Jung means by individuation. The synthesizing of these contradictions. That's what an individual is. Individual does not mean separate, as you well know. Individuation and making integrity could be the synonyms. And integrity means not split. So here he's split. So you could say psychologically, this guy has no integrity. Now, if you tell him that, I'm sure he'd go through a roof, but psychologically he doesn't. If he can say contradictory things and not be bothered by them.
So this may be picky, but is you called him a borderline personality.
Yeah.
That's
it.
An example of it.
Yeah.
So does that go along with the split animus, or, you know, the chicken and the egg, I guess?
Well, yeah, I think they're coexistent. When I think of borderline, I think of split. Well, one to the other.
Because I know a woman who is her
problem. Yeah, I think I know her too. And this is really Freudian language, but I do find it helpful that they kind of divide the world up into two types, narcissists and borderlines. And again, you know, it's maybe dangerous, but on the other hand, it's helpful. Where narcissists would be like the well-functioning, self-centered person of our time. And they're hard to get close to because they're always in control and they're aloof and it's always about them. But they're consistent. They are always this way. And these people will, thank you very much, these people will flip. And these people are capable of great friendship. Now, Pally isn't because he's got a mixture of the two traits, but they're a lot easier to get close to emotionally, and they're suffering visibly, and they're not afraid to reach out for help very often. Now, he's a little different in that regard, but there's a continuum.
You're saying the borderline is easier to get close to?
Yeah, they're not as in control, and they're suffering over the fact that they're not in control, where a narcissist may be able to hold down a job. You know, and they're generally very successful because of their coping skills. So they've got the money, so they attract the opposite sex. They have the appearance of relationship. But, of course, it's all an act.
Can there be a mixture?
And I think Pally would be a mixture.
Okay.
Yeah, and they call those the narcissistic borderline in the Freudian language. So he's both. I mean, he's hard to get close to, and yet we've seen there are times when he genuinely reaches out. You know, thank you for this soul help. A classical narcissist would never say that. They would be, you know, they would be in control and having you feel like there's something wrong with you.
Used.
And they use people. Mm-hmm. And they're very good at using people, mm-hmm. Right. So that's just, as I say, it's not really Jung's language, but it is a nice little schema. And so you don't get thrown when you're talking to these people. It's helpful to realize, oh yeah, here it is. But it's also why they're so very difficult to work with. Because I work with, I've got one person like that now. We'll have a discussion, and the next hour it's like that discussion never happened. And this goes on week after week after week. After years, almost after decade, and really after 10 years, this one person I'm thinking of, I thought, for the first time, I've seen carryover from 1 hour to the next. That's how long it takes. Now, and it could flip right back. I don't know, but I had the feeling maybe we're getting somewhere. but it's very frustrating. And the only, I mean, it sounds awful, but the only thing you can really hope for these people is that they're suffering. They're lonely. And they're knowing something's wrong. I don't know what it is, so that keeps their nose to the grindstone. Okay. Anything else? That takes us to the middle of 110. There's more about the archetypal sequence. That's just talk, I think. He mentions that Judaism and Christianity don't symbolize this rhythm. Now, he doesn't discard the rhythm. He discards that the rhythm can become material at this point. First of all, I don't know whether that's true. Does Christianity disregard the rhythm? It might. I think what he would say is, in Christianity, there's one death and resurrection. I think that's what he's saying. In Judaism, there's none.
Would you say again on the one?
That with Christianity, there's one death and resurrection.
Okay.
And this cyclic idea, which, you know, I think some Christians would say, well, if we take the resurrection as a metaphor, that life is a series of death, mm-hmm. deaths and rebirths. Mm-hmm. I think that would not be the traditional interpretation,
yeah.
that there's one objective event.
But as with Judaism, I think if you look at the Kabbalistic, the image of the tree with the roots and the heavens and the branches and the phenomenal world and the whole notion of divine emanations and then the various separate off of the tree of life, had he looked at that with his mathematical gift, I think he might have changed his
statement. That's a good point. Because, well, I think what he's saying is traditional Judaism.
Yeah, exactly. But
right. Definitely, in the Kabbalah would be that, I think. Yeah, I mean, it's just hot air, I just mentioned.
I was just thinking, perhaps, in small in Christianity, the idea of the rhythm is that at least in the Mass, there is the constant experience.
Transubstantiation.
The re-experience of the
death. I like that. Right. We'll look at this what he calls the opposition between Catholicism and Protestantism. Again, I think it's just nonsense, but hold off until we get there, which is like in a page or two. The thing that I think we can end with the Chiss chapter with is important, and that's the dream on page 111. And by the way, I didn't mark it. It should be dream 31, I think. Or is it 31. Dream 31. And that dream was on December 20th, 1952.
What page are you on?
Page 111. A major war is going on. There is a Chinese couple on my side. See, that's good news now. In the course of the fighting, I drive the opposition back. Also very good news. When I am finally alone with the Chinese again, I catch sight of the stranger. That should be a capital S. I demand a formal contract for the Chinese people. To their delight, he agrees. So good news. The bad news is that the opposition hasn't been defeated. So it'll be back. But you can see here he is struggling to understand what's going on. And that is the nature of these people. There's a struggle and then there's a respite. A struggle and a respite.
You know, the people I think of that you're describing don't have much capacity, from my observation, for reflection.
Right.
He seems to reflect.
Yes.
You know, but it gets...
But it's intellectual reflection. I think that's the problem.
It doesn't touch him.
But you're right, and that's why I think those categories are a little dangerous. Mm-hmm. Or apply them in grades, yeah. Gradation. In a way, I think his reflection, well, it's both. It's an advantage, but it's a disadvantage because it sounds so good. It sounds like he is reflecting, but he really isn't looking at his behavior. He's looking at his images, but he doesn't make the link from the image to his behavior.
Is that because you can't think and value at the same time? You think and feel?
That's a good question. I think it's deeper than that. I think that, well, you have a couple of explanations. And again, Jung doesn't really go in for these analyses. He just takes you where you are and then where you're going to go. But the Freudians have, of course. And what their point of view is that imaginative capacity is killed in the bad relationship to the mother.
Now, how does it get to the mother?
That's
always get to the mother.
That's
have you been listening?
I'm sorry to have said that, but that's what they say. And you know, I think there's something to it. If you think of a healthy mother infant, how the mother will play with the infant's mind and play with its food and play with its eating and play with its and enter into that playful mode of the child, where a cold mother will not. And so there isn't this reciprocity between the child's imagination and the mother's receiving it. And that's how they say it. Because if you look at a child, they have this imagination. They will describe their behavior in imagistic form. That's the natural language of the child. And it somehow gets lost. Now, who knows? That's, as I say, that's one explanation. But no, I think it's a... well, in your field, it's a laming of the artistic imagination.
Although you do see children that have no connection to the mother, that have a huge life in images.
Well, their idea is that somehow she kills it.
I
don't know whether that's right or not, but...
Well, I think it depends on the person. You know? Definitely. I mean, twins. Look at twins. Look at how many they are.
When you say they, are you talking about Freudian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Jung never, I mean, he almost never indulges in how did we get there questions. He always, or almost always, indulges in how are we going to get to where we're going questions.
I have a question.
Yeah.
It's been bugging me so much. In that, on the one hand, we really can give Polly a hard time, but from time to time, I get this sense that he is playing with fire. That that if he were to give himself up to this process,
mm-hmm.
That could be very dangerous to him. And I'm wondering, do you have that feeling? Mm-hmm. Actually, given that,
yes, I do.
Jung himself almost got lost, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people like Nietzsche.
Nietzsche did get lost.
So is it possible that he could have gotten lost too?
Yeah. We'll see shortly that he says, Jung told him, you're in danger of going psychotic. And Jung didn't say that sort of thing just for the fun of it. Well,
I mean, if he had any questions at all about it.
I think what Jung was saying is, you know, you can't afford to play with this material. This is serious stuff, and I would also imagine him saying there's a way out of it, but the way to destruction is to frivolously indulge.
Yeah.
He was damned if he did and damned if he didn't, because he died early.
Right, right. That to me is, I mean, people will say, and I've talked about this, you know, publicly, people will say, well, he wasn't strong enough and you should be understanding. Well, okay, you're understanding, then what? He's dead. And it's a horrible position to be in, but I think what Jung and von Franz, I think von Franz was much less patient with him than Jung was. Jung's patience really amazed me. Was that you've got this fire, and one way or the other, it's going to kill you. It's going to kill you either psychologically or physically. So we're throwing our weight behind the psychological process. But yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. I think there are several reasons for that. One, you know, honestly, one of the images that has always stuck in my mind is the landing at Normandy. You see these poor guys getting off the boats and they don't make it past the shore. And I think Pally was such a guy. There was this terrific burst of something that assaulted humanity on the world stage, which we experienced as World War I and World War II. And it took lives, and his is one of the lives it took. Just like those guys who died on the beaches of Normandy.
80,000.
Was it? So, you could look at it as a personal issue, which I think to some extent it was, but I also think it was a collective issue that he was at the pulse beat of history and was assaulted with emotional fire, just like soldiers were assaulted with physical fire, and it killed him. That's basically where I would come to. Had he not made the bomb, had he not had some measure of conscience, this wouldn't have happened to him. But it's like he took the whole world on. Or more like the whole world took him on. As it did Jung. And, you know, as Ted said, it almost toppled Jung. But this is the fate of the creative personality. You solve in your soul what is destroying the world, and then try to articulate
it. It seems too that people like von Franz and Edinger managed to prevail, but they were also lonely.
Yeah, that's the price he did not want to pay. Mm. Right.
But ironically, it wasn't.
Yeah. In his soul, he was lonely. He had lots of personal acquaintances. And in a way, I think the situation has changed. I do feel that times are more open to this. So in a way, their loneliness was preparing a product for us. And I think now it can be understood in a way that it couldn't have been understood. And, you know, this group not included, but generally it's not accepted in the public, but if you go to larger cities, you can feel. When I spoke up in Toronto on this last time, I looked out in the audience, and the auditorium was filled, and the people were literally sitting on the edge of their seats. And I thought, this is going in. So there are pockets, I think, now where it is ready to be received. And what they went through, in a way, was for us. It was a gift to us to continue developing this material and then presenting. Because remember, time and time again, we're seeing the Chinese woman, the stranger, they want it to be communicated. That unconscious wants its point of view out there. And I think we are, you know, in a way, heirs to their suffering, and it's an exciting time to be sharing this stuff. And I think we'll get more and more. There'll be more and more receptivity to it. At least I hope so.
How are you going to encourage people to embrace suffering? Everybody wants everything to be as convenient as possible. The whole culture says, you know, quick, easy, fast, you know, take these 12 steps and you're there. I mean, watch this video and look at this tape, you know. nobody really wants, I mean, the challenge of doing the hard work, I mean, hell, pollen quailed at it, my God. What the lesser intellect to do, you know? I mean, it's a tough call.
It's a tough call, and maybe I'm too much of an idealist. But I'll give you an example. I was talking to my little French partner in French class, and she's 20 years old, and she said, for example, I am concerned about the quality of education, and I am designing my own major in education advocacy. And she said, I have no idea how I'm going to make a living with this. My parents, my dad's a steel worker in northern Indiana, working class family. My parents said they had X amount of dollars to put me through school. I could have gone to a state school and I wouldn't have had to pay anything, but I decided to come to Butler with the agreement that I would make up the difference. And she said, I'm scared as heck. I don't know how I'm going to do it. But my little inner voice said, do this, and I want to follow it. So there's somebody who is choosing a more difficult path. And she's 20 years old.
And consciously.
And consciously choosing it. And working 20 hours a week at some stupid restaurant to help pay her studies, when she could have gone to another school, gotten a degree in pharmacy, and made $70,000 when she gets out of college. So there are these people around. Okay, 113. Now we just kind of meander through some details for a bit. But it'll get hard before too long. This bit of... Well, we'll take a break and...
I told him we're going to break in about 20 minutes to sign. We've got groundwork to do. They're working on the pole.
Oh, okay.
You're parked right in front of it, so he just wondered if you could do it.
You think I should do it?
No.
Okay. We'll take a break. Sure.
Okay.
What he calls the conflict between Protestantism and Catholicism is discussed in the letter to Fiertz. Fiertz is the, some of you know that Women's Dionysian Initiation, that's her son. And she had two sons. One was this physicist, and the other was one of our faculty at the Jung Institute. So Marcus Fiertz was also a professor of physics at the, I think first in Basel, and then eventually in Zurich. But again, I don't get this, and maybe you can see more than I do, but we've talked about the split between Flood and Kepler. We'll come back to that. But Flood was the alchemist, and Kepler was the scientist. And these two guys had a big argument. We'll talk about that more today. We talked about it back in chapter 3. And Pauli took that conflict as indicative of the problem that science entered into when it eschewed all of the knowledge of what the alchemists were trying to accomplish, and said that what is true is only what's repeatable. So at the birth of science, all of alchemy was called superstition and mysticism. But as we've seen, alchemy also contains these figures like Mercurius and Sophia. So that's the period in history when this split occurred that we are now trying to go back to and solve. And that, to me, makes sense, Flood and Kepler. But then Pauli equates the opposition between those two people as the opposition between Catholicism and Protestantism, which doesn't make any sense because they were both Protestants. In any case, you're going to hear that, so I thought we'd just mention it. He calls Protestantism physics and science and linear and perceptive, and he calls Catholicism psychological and intuitive. I just don't think it holds water, but that's what he says.
That's a pretty big insult to Jung, calling his psychology not scientific.
Well, wait, it gets better. Yeah, we're going to see, we'll probably get to it today, if not next time. This is the beginning of the fight with Jung, where first he's going to have a fight with Jung, we'll see that, and he's going to have a fight with von Franz, we'll see that. So what we're moving into now is the beginning of the end. And he really insults Jung repeatedly. And I think Jung just finally said, you know, heck with you. Although, did I mention Jung's, Pali's final words? If there's one person I'd like to talk to now, it's C.G. Jung. Yeah. According to my action figure, Jung's final words were, let's have a really good wine tonight.
Yeah.
What a difference.
One of the reasons I was just thinking he includes physics on the Protestant is at least in some of the writers, you know, the Protestant dominated was more industrialized.
Yeah.
They made more use of physics and to industrialize
right.
than the
Catholic. Well, I can understand, I understand the split between his two categories. I can kind of see why he says Protestantism, Catholicism, but I don't know why that's important to him. He wasn't Protestant. It sounds like one more of these intellectual games he plays. And particularly when he's given that as a way of elucidating the opposition between Kepler and Flood, both of whom were Protestant. Flood was Anglican, and Kepler was Lutheran. So I just, but in any case, I think we can accept that this split, maybe mislabeled, is what Pauli is working with. The linear and the scientific, and the nonlinear and the imagistic. And it's arguing over that point that he and Jung will come to an impasse. The author then goes on and just observes that the dance of the Chinese woman is meant to unify the split. Because remember, she does this, up and down. She's alternating her fingers to show their equivalence. So that the unconscious is saying to Pali, there is a way to solve this thing. And that's your task. That's what we've just been saying up to now. Now comes more denial in my feelings. Look at the last paragraph. The dreams emphasize the objective significance of the contrary position to the natural sciences in the form of a calling to be a professor at a university, this often being a new university, but often also our Zurich Polytechnic, to which I have just received a first calling which I characteristically have not yet accepted. Or the stranger seeks to be admitted to study at the Polytechnic, but encounters resistance from the conventional contemporary science. Now, what do you see wrong about that statement?
I just find it hard to follow, too.
Well, I don't know how much of that is me translating from the German. I can tell you his German is murder to translate. Very convoluted. But there's something else missing.
Anyway, he says that characteristically have not yet accepted.
Nope. That's true.
Well, the feeling. There's feeling missing. It's all intellectual.
Yeah, there's something else. What does a new professorship theme mean?
Trying to that.
More specific. It's a very specific.
New attitude.
More specific.
Talking about synchronicity.
Yeah, he is to lecture on it. And that's not, that he completely forgets that here. that it's simply, he talks about it as a standpoint which has validity, but he doesn't mention it's his job to articulate it.
Well, so far, he has not really accepted that.
No, he never accepts it.
Why is we're going to get to why he doesn't accept it.
We will, like a game of pickup sticks, I think, start looking at the various pieces of his not accepting it. Yeah. Why is another question.
It seems he doesn't want to put himself out there.
I think that's the bottom line. He doesn't want the hassle.
Well, or the condemnation of his peers.
Yeah.
They're making fun of what he would be moving toward, that they would disdain.
Right.
I mean, he just didn't want to. And that is a hard place to be in.
It's a hard place to be.
Put yourself out there knowing that your legs are going to get chopped off.
Right. Yes, definitely.
Mm-hmm. 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 Well, I suppose the huge humiliating thing is that he could be looked on as unscientific.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the biggest sin.
Mm-hmm.
That would be crushing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, Kepler and Fluff, top of 114. I need just to review their contract, because it's going to come up in the language. And this isn't going to say anything new, it's just restating what we've already said. Flood was the alchemist. And Kepler was, and he was British, and Kepler was the guy who first gave accurate formulas to the elliptical orbits of the planets. I think first, or was it that Galileo, just go back to history, said that the planets circle around the sun, well, that was already a big deal. For which Galileo was arrested and spent the rest of his life under house arrest by the Inquisition for saying that. And what Kepler did then is just take that and say, no, they're not circles, they're ellipses, and worked out the mathematics to describe them. And that held right up until the beginning of the 20th century, really.
See, Pilate is probably saying that there were the Catholics who enforced that restriction on their thinking. And that's where you can probably do it.
That could be. That could be, yeah. That's helpful, yes. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. In their argument, Flood and Kepler used an image, which is what I'm getting at. Flood said of Kepler that he had, let me make sure I get this right, he had a hold of a snake, but only by the tail. And Kepler said of Flood that he had a hold of a snake, but only by the head, and that only in his dreams. Now, what that means is that the tail would be the effects of the effect of physical motion, and the head would be the spiritual cause of that motion, which physics denies there's a spiritual cause. So that's why Flood was attacking Kepler. He was saying, you're forgetting the reason that life exists. All you do is describe the way things move. You're not concerned with the, in his mind, the impulses, namely God, that make things move. And then Kepler, as a scientist, would write back and say, well, that's great for you to talk about the unit impulse of things, but that's just a fantasy. You have no way of demonstrating that. So it's really that argument and the snake is indicative of this whole split between alchemy and science and the split within Pauli himself. What Pauli wanted to do is get them both together in himself. Understand the deeper meaning of things and its relationship to science. At least in principle he did.
So what would it mean for Flood to have hold of the snake only by its tail?
He's saying that of Kepler. All Kepler does is describe movements. He doesn't give reasons.
Yeah. Okay.
And Kepler and Flood says, I give reasons, namely that there is this world soul and there's God involved. Uroboros.
That symbolizes that sense.
Yes. Right. So, Pauli wrote to Jung, I am still consistently surprised at this insistence of the unconscious on the new professorship with its lectures in auditoriums and on my appointment. And I wonder what such a professor might say who does not just hold the tail but grasps it in his hand. In the theoretical, I wonder if I missed something there. He means grasp the head in its hand. That's what he means, huh? Namely theoretical physics, but also such a professor might say who does not just hold the tail but grasps it in his hand, namely theoretical physics, but who also grasps the head mentally and not just in dreams. Yeah, that's right the way it stands. So at least he's reflecting on what is being asked of him. And this is an image for all that we've talked about. That's all. Now, here he's trying to work, and yet I don't think it works. I'll read you what the author says. Pauli felt then that the new quantum physics could be a help to bring the two standpoints of Kepler and Flood closer together. Now that is something there. But where he goes with it, I'm not sure, and neither is the author. The firm grip on the tail, that is physics, provided me with unhoped aids which can be utilized with more important undertakings as well to grasp the head mentally. It actually seems to me that in the complementarity of physics with its resolution of the wave-particle opposites, there is a sort of role model or example of that other more comprehensive conjunctio. For the smaller conjunctio in the context of physics, completely unintentionally on the part of its discoverers, has certain characteristics that can probably be used to resolve the other pairs of opposites. Let's look at that.
Let's do.
Should we have a stretch first?
Are you speaking English?
No.